the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We have moved into the age of the tentative pregnancy. That's what some are calling the current situation in which the prenatal tests available to so many parents now afford American parents the opportunity to decide whether or not this fetus or embryo is acceptable. And if not, simply destroy the embryo or simply abort the fetus. This is going on now routinely. We've talked about it on this program with relation to Down syndrome. But a big story in the New York Times Magazine from Sunday really blows the story much larger. And in a larger context, it really draws our attention to the fact that many of these pregnancies are simply becoming, well, there's the word, tentative. It's like you're pregnant, but then let's find out that you really have the kind of baby you want and that you do not have a baby that has something that you don't want, such as a disease or a genetic impairment. And then you can abort if it's unsatisfactory. You have the rise of these new lawsuits, wrongful birth and wrongful life. We'll be talking about how these things have been handled in the courts and what this says about America and what it says about our basic undermining of this, the sacredness, sanctity of human life. What does it mean about human dignity? And if we're going to be setting standards for acceptable life, who's going to set those standards? And what would they be? First, to review some issues in the news, what about the almost people? According to official sources, Britain now counts 117,619 frozen human embryos in storage. That's over 100,000. As of 2003, U.S. sources revealed over 400,000, and it is now thought that that is much larger, perhaps as many as 750,000 frozen human embryos in storage. What does this say about our understanding of human nature? And when we're talking about human dignity, what does this say about our understanding of the dignity of what it means to be human? Writing in a London newspaper, The Independent, Cole Morton reports that a much-publicized controversy over the future of six frozen embryos in Britain is awakening many persons to what she calls, and listen to this, the chilly world of the almost people. The report goes on, and I want to read directly from it. The eight-celled embryo that would become Lois Walker, who, by the way, is now almost 6 years of age, spent those 30 months in a plastic tube stored in a metal flask in a fertility clinic. Was she alive? Did she have any human rights? What should have happened to her if her parents had split up and one of them had stopped wanting a baby? End quote. That is, by the way, why the controversy erupted in Great Britain. There was a couple, they were unmarried, by the way, that had participated in creating some embryos, and even after they split up, the woman wanted to implant the embryos in her womb in order to seek to have a baby, and the former male partner refused, and he won, even at the European Court of Human Rights, and so that's the controversy. Picking back up on Morton's story, such questions have been raised again by the bitter legal battle between an infertile woman who wants to thaw her frozen embryos for one last chance of pregnancy and her former boyfriend who has refused consent. The European Court of Human Rights has ruled that Natalie Evans cannot use the embryo she made with her ex-partner unless he agrees. He wants a second hearing. She wants a second hearing, but time is running out. Now listen now, why is time running out? Because of the courts? No. Under UK law, the embryos must be destroyed in October when it will be 5 years since they were made. So in Great Britain right now, if you create an embryo and it is not put in the womb, then it must be destroyed 5 years after it was made. And, of course, we're even searching here for the right verb, aren't we? Do we actually make these? Do we create these? Do we allow them to happen? Do we become the catalyst for making them happen? Even the language betrays us. But her language betrays her when she really takes on this issue. And listen to these paragraphs. Science and the law both work on the basis that an embryo at this very early stage is a subhuman scrap of genetic material and only becomes a person later in its development. You know, when you read a statement like that, you can hardly believe that this is in a major British newspaper. And the language is just so right up front. And by the way, the language is right. The language is accurate in describing the kind of worldview, the kind of mentality that is really at work here. Science and the law both work on the basis that an embryo at this very early stage is a subhuman scrap of genetic material and only becomes a person later in its development, period. Now, let me insert myself again. At what point? Who gets to decide when this embryo becomes a person? Is it when it is an embryo? Is it when it's a fetus? Well, then, what about abortion? You see where the logic of this goes? And then what about when it's a young child? Peter Singer says you can even kill a young child that doesn't have certain capacities, such as the capacity to anticipate the future and to communicate and to establish relationships, because that individual is not yet a person. We're not talking about a slippery slope here. We're already at the bottom of this slope. Back to Cole Martin's article. She says this: the majority of people going through IVF probably agree it does make what they are doing far less morally complicated, but those who have been through IVF or made it happen know that even the clearest of minds can be ambushed by emotion and find themselves personalizing embryos. Interesting there. In other words, if you believe that the embryo is a person, if you begin to personalize the embryo and treat it like a human being, then you have been, by definition, here's the quote, ambushed by emotion. It's not a rational decision. It's simply an emotional state. Andy Glue, senior embryologist at the Essex Fertility Center in Brackhurst Hill, says, some people ask to take home the ones that have not been used. We make sure that life has been terminated before we let them out of the building, but then we do give couples the embryos in a water-based solution so that they can bury them in the garden or whatever they need to do. You know, this is one of the scariest articles I've seen in a very long time. It's scary because of what it says. It's scary because of where it's published. It's scary because of the actual brutality of the language. It just is very difficult even to articulate here on the air. Talking about human embryos in this way, we have now reached the point where human embryos are being described in an article in a major newspaper straightforwardly as subhuman scraps of genetic material. And then we have the suggestion of this fertility center that the way to handle this is to terminate the life in the embryos that are not going to be inserted and then give them to the parents so the parents can go home and bury them in the garden, or as the article ends, or whatever they need to do. Folks, when we reach this point, when we're looking at this squarely in the face, we're looking at the culture of death sneering back at us. You know, you just have to wonder what can follow this. In the 20th century, with Birkenau and Auschwitz and Treblinka and the Holocaust, in the 20th century with Stalin's murders by the millions, Pol Pot's killing fields, how can we not look at this and see that in the 21st century, we are now putting ourselves in the position where very quickly we can and will do worse? We can and we will even go beyond those atrocities of the 20th century, because now, given the realities of technology, we can go right into the womb. We don't have to wait for them to be born. We can abort them before they ever breathe their first breath. We don't even have to wait for them to be inserted in the womb. We can just examine the embryo, and we can decide if that embryo is worthy of life, and if not, we can simply destroy it, then send it home with the patients once life has been terminated so that they can bury the embryo in the garden or whatever they need to do. Writing at Slate.com and at the Washington Post, Dahlia Lithwick argues that those who have hang-ups over gay adoption simply need to get over it. Here's how she begins the article. Quote, a heads up to those of you who are still fretting about the alleged evils of gay marriage, the parade has moved on. Lithwick contends that the world of family law and policy has now accepted homosexual parenting and homosexual adoption as normal and legal, and that this trend is irreversible. She says we just have to get over it. Try as you may, she says, to vote or legislate your way out of a country that solemnizes such relationships, committed gay couples are already giving birth to, adopting, and fostering children. Whether or not same-sex marriage becomes widely legal in America, same-sex parenting is a done deal, and around the country, courts are increasingly beginning to recognize that reality with more generous notions of what parenting and family mean. That's a quote from the article. Notice the way it's contextualized here, more generous notions, not more accurate, but more generous. And generous in whose eyes? She documents in this article that when judges decided that they would make decisions on their own intuition or decision or evaluation of what's in, quote, the best interest of the child, end quote, that would automatically lead to a revolutionizing of the concept of family, what she calls here this generous notion of what parenting and family mean. In other words, we have judges acting like social workers, deciding for themselves what's in the best interest of the child. And Dahlia Lithwick said the inevitable result of this is going to be that gay parenting is simply standardized. And if you wonder what that means, just go to Boston, Massachusetts, where the Roman Catholic Church is now backing out of the adoption business in that state altogether because the state of Massachusetts was requiring the Roman Catholic Church to promote gay parenting or get out of the adoption business. And the Catholics in Boston are getting out. Now, what's in the best interest of the child? Think of all those children that won't be served and won't be adopted because there the Roman Catholic Diocese said we can't go along with this political correctness and with the destruction of the family. This is what happens when human beings decide to turn their back on the reality of the family and claim they're doing it for the child. Be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're going to be talking about a difficult subject today, but it's one that ought to be a concern of every single thinking Christian, and especially those who are parents, and especially those who are Christian leaders, and those who have the opportunity to influence parents as well. Because this whole idea of a tentative pregnancy is a really chilling concept. Let's just talk about what it means. It means that pregnancy is no longer assumed to mean that we welcome the child in the womb. But now that we put this child under medical and genetic screening in order to determine whether or not this is the child we want or whether or not this is the child we will accept. Writing in the New York Times magazine, Elizabeth Weil addresses the issue of wrongful birth claims and the ethical confusion into which these issues have now come. And they're debated all over this society, mostly in the courts. She acknowledges the issue points not only to confusion but to significant danger. And this is interesting, of course, because as she recounts in her essay, Weil and her husband decided roughly 2 years ago to abort an unborn child when she discovered at 23 weeks of gestation that, and I'm quoting, our unborn son had contracted cytomegalovirus. That disease, if contracted by the mother for the first time while she is pregnant and then passed along to her fetus, can lead to severe birth defects. From her own article, she said, most likely our child would be deaf, blind, and have serious mental retardation. A doctor friend told me that this prognosis would make a child born with Down look like a walk in the park, but no one could tell us for sure what our unborn child's or son's health would be like. What is more, no good studies existed because most of the women in the samples terminated before birth. So Weil and her husband decided to abort. She says this, we did what seemed right at the time. We aborted. In her article, she says they are still satisfied with that answer, and she speaks, very strangely, of learning to love the child they aborted. Now, in her article, she really looks at the bigger picture, not only of her experience, but of the eugenic considerations that are now playing a part in pregnancy. Eugenics goes back to the science of good breeding. And we know what that's like if you're breeding cattle or if you're breeding horses or breeding any other kind of animal. But are we breeding human beings? In 1967, the New Jersey Supreme Court said no. It rejected a wrongful birth claim on this very basis. It said this. It said the sanctity of the single human life is the decisive factor in this case. Eugenic considerations are not controlling. We are not talking here about the breeding of prize cattle. But just 6 years after 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the Roe v. Wade decision, and that changed everything. Now abortion became a supposed constitutional right. And once you combine the desire for a child without infirmity or with certain characteristics, with the ability to abort, certainly in the early trimesters, without any kind of justification necessary, then what you end up with is exactly what we now have. But, of course, you must add to that the fact that there has been an exponential increase in the number of genetic tests, prenatal tests. Between 1993 and 2003, a tenfold increase from roughly 100 available tests to 1,000 available tests. Of course, that statistic just goes through 2003. 3 years later, that number is certainly far higher. And we are now being told that genetic testing may be so routine and so specific and so comprehensive in short order that you'll be able to receive something like a computer printout from the genetic code of your embryo or unborn baby to tell you exactly what you are looking at in terms of intelligence range, IQ, in terms of physical characteristics, health, color of eyes, color of hair, not to mention gender. athletic ability within certain constraints. All these things may be available, in at least in a good probability, through genetic testing. What are we going to do with that? Currently in the United States of America, there are no medical or ethical or legal boundaries that say you cannot abort that fetus or destroy that embryo for any reason. In other words, right now, it's just the wild, wild west of reproductive technologies. That's how some have described the United States. And we should be chilled to the bone to know that you can look at British newspapers, you can look at Dutch and German and Belgian newspapers, and find advertisements for reproductive tourism to the United States, where people can come and get technologies, or they can come and abort babies here that that would not be allowed in host countries, even in secular and liberal Western Europe. Well, in Elizabeth Wilde's article, she really goes into this in detail, and it's a very fascinating and chilling thing. She asked the question, should it be okay to terminate a deaf child? What about a blind one? How mentally retarded is too mentally retarded? What if the child will develop a serious disease like Huntington's later in life? According to one reproductive scholar, this is Susan Crocklin in Newton, Massachusetts, as reproductive genetics opens up new possibilities, we should expect to see more of these cases, and we should expect to see more novel cases. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to talk about how we as Christians should respond to this basic question. Would it ever be right, to abort an unborn child because of anything that could be released or revealed in a test? Would it ever be right? Could it be justified under any circumstances? That's the big question. It's not hypothetical. This is a question that is faced by hundreds and thousands of parents or prospective parents in America today. And by the way, I prefer to say parent rather than prospective parent, because once conception has taken place, so far as I'm concerned, you're a parent. You're just a parent of an unborn child. But there are all kinds of parents that are facing this. Married parents, unmarried parents, single parents. And they're making decisions based upon what they are being told by doctors. There are genetic counselors who are now routinely suggesting if there's any probability of a genetic fault that perhaps the couple ought to start all over again, I'll get this, quote, with a clean slate, end quote. Elizabeth Weil, who, with her husband, came to the agreement that they would abort their own baby, their own unborn child diagnosed with a genetic defect, she says, look, the medical profession is now tending towards a presumption of termination if there's a problem. And we know what this is going to look like. A presumption of termination means at some point we can expect that insurance companies following this logic will say, look, if you're going to allow this child to be born, you're going to bear all the medical expenses because we're not going to pay for it. This test has revealed that this is an avoidable problem. And if it's an avoidable problem, then our insurance coverage isn't going to include you in this decision. How long is it before doctors say, you know, I don't want to risk some kind of malpractice lawsuit by having a less than perfect baby born. And so if you want this baby to be born, then you're just going to have to find a way to have it born, because I'm not going to be the doctor to preside over this. How long is it before neighbors say to parents, how could you have allowed this baby to be born? I mean, we've already documented on this program, and I've documented in writing, how few babies are now born with Down syndrome. And it's not because they're not being conceived and producing embryos and fetuses with Down syndrome. It's because prenatal testing is giving the information and the babies are being aborted. You know, Elizabeth Weil asked the question, what is an acceptable IQ? She's pointing towards exactly where this logic leads. What is an acceptable child? If every pregnancy is now going to be tentative, and if we're going to demand a child that meets our expectations, if the revelation of a genetic problem is going to be the justification for aborting the child, then who is acceptable? How much athletic ability? What color eyes? What gender? This is frightening stuff. And how many of us are perfect? I think we know the answer to that question. We should never minimize the difficulty experienced by many families, many parents dealing with children that have truly incredible needs. But are we going to say that this is life unworthy of life? And this is life that should never have been allowed to live? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We are talking about the tentative pregnancy, wrongful birth claims, and these are working their way through the courts. And right now, in about half the states, these are being very well received. Babies are being born, and their parents generally are doing the suing, saying that had we known that this baby was carrying this marker, or had we known it was afflicted with this disease, we would have aborted, and therefore this birth is a wrongful birth. Just think about that. It's like an oxymoron. How can you put wrongful birth together in a compound? Wrongful life suits are those brought by the individuals themselves later, and the courts have had a difficult time dealing with that because, get this, the courts have said, we really can't make a judgment as to whether existence or non-existence is preferable. Now, when you're down to that kind of legal nonsense, you know you're in big trouble. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Susan, listening on WTBN in Tampa, Florida. Susan, your turn.
Hi, I just wanted to say I visited the Holocaust Museum last week with my son, and what makes me think of this is that Hitler could get rid of the Jews the way he did because no one stood up until it was, you know, coming after them, and it's the same way with this. Who's to say that if we don't stand up now, then if I get pregnant and they find out that it has Down syndrome or whatever, I'm forced to have an abortion against my will. You know, rights are taken away.
Yeah, Susan, your logic is unfortunately already taking hold in some quarters. An obligation to abort is already, and that's not quite coercion yet, but an obligation to abort is what many writers are very much concerned about, especially those who are advocates for Down syndrome children. Because insurance companies and others are really putting pressure, and so are medical doctors in many cases, putting pressure on parents to say, look, you have an obligation not to bring this child into the world. And when you talk about coerced or forced abortions, that in history has awful parallels. And it is also something that is arising in the Netherlands right now. I mentioned this about 2 weeks ago. In the Netherlands, there is now a proposal from a legislator that children who are thought not to have the potential of being welcomed into a happy family should be aborted, and mothers should be forced to abort them if they can't prove that they're going to be accepted and loved and cherished. You know, that sounds plausible to the wisdom of the world. That sounds plausible to the culture of death. It just can't be plausible to people who understand the sanctity of human life. Susan, thank you for your call. I really appreciate your voice added to this conversation. Let's go to Laura calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Laura, your turn.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I have kind of a three-sided argument, and it'll be quick. But first of all, you know, you mentioned being a parent, and you're right. When you are pregnant, you are a parent, and you're a parent for life, and you don't know if that child is going to have problems down the road, even if you have a perfectly normal child at birth. So that's my first point. And my second one is in the case of, like, rape or incest, I remember reading a book called Silent No More, and the man did a study. I can't remember his name, but he did a study on women who had abortions after they were raped. And all of these women who had, abortions and chose life, the women who chose life after rape, you know, they were blessed because of it, because of that life, and it helped heal them after that traumatic incident. And my third point is I have a daughter with Down syndrome, and when I was pregnant, they did lots of ultrasounds. They did lots of measurements. They never saw that she had Down syndrome, and I am thankful because she is such a blessing to our lives. So doctors can be wrong, and when you become a parent, you're a parent when you decide, let's have a child.
You know, Laura, your three points are all essential. That's a triple play right there, and one that I really appreciate. And I like where you began, just in your affirmation of what parenthood really means, and of the fact that we don't know our children are going to be healthy tomorrow. even if they've been healthy. And, you know, my wife and I are so thankful to have teenage children, but nothing is guaranteed. And you are living in a culture, aren't we, in which we're being told that those guarantees should be taken for granted. And Laura, thank you for your testimony about your own daughter, the sweetness of that. First of all, the correction that you will really help a lot of our listeners to know that these tests are often not accurate anyway. In your case, they failed to indicate Down syndrome in the case of your daughter. But as Elizabeth Weil makes clear in this article, there are also a lot of false positives. There are an awful lot of tests that show that genetic problems that later are shown not to exist. And that ought to frighten us as well. Laura, thank you so much for your call. May God bless you, your family, your husband, and that precious little girl. And may the glory of God be shown in your love for her and in her face and in her giftedness to all of us. We need all of us, not just those who don't have Down syndrome, not just those who don't have other diseases. We need all of us, and we must see all of us, every single human being, as made in the image of God. We'll be right back. Welcome back. These are tough issues, the kind of issues we are called to confront. There's just no ducking this stuff. There's no ducking the question of the sanctity of human life. It's not being debated looking back in history, the Third Reich and the efforts at eugenics, even in the United States in the early 20th century. We're not talking about abstract medical ethics. We're talking about the tentative pregnancy. And it's a reality all across this country. Let's go to Scott calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN. Go ahead, Scott.
Hello, I'm a molecular biologist here in Tampa, Florida, and just calling because having personal experience with these tests, firsthand experience, it's very easy to contaminate these tests and to skew the results. And my best, one of my best friends is a living proof of a test result that came out as a false positive. The doctors told her parents that she would probably be born retarded and recommended that they abort the child. But her parents are Christians with a good moral compass, and they kept her, and she came out just fine. She's one of the smartest people I know. And if they hadn't had that moral compass, I wouldn't have her as a friend, and my best friend wouldn't have her as a wife. So,
well, what a testimony there, Scott. Thank you. And when you talk about a false positive, you know, the tests are indicating more and more that there may even be genetic development within the embryo towards genetic health. In fact, Elizabeth Weil actually documents this. As you move along gestation, the embryo tends to have fewer positives, whether false or accurate, indicating that there seems to be, even within what God has put in the genetic code, a way of genetic correction in many cases. And so we ought to be very, very careful about assuming what we know. Great testimony, Scott, and a very personal one, and I appreciate that very much. Let's go to Kara calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Go ahead, Kara.
Yes, I was just wanting to say that there's absolutely no guarantee of a perfect child, even with this genetic testing. A girlfriend of mine had twins that were born at 27 weeks gestation, both tested absolutely normal. At the time they were born, they used drugs to sustain their life, to keep them alive, and that created some abnormalities. And the little girl ended up dying in 18 days, but the little boy survived. And because of these drugs that were kept him alive, he ended up being deaf and having cerebral palsy. So you can have a completely normal child that, because of completely unforeseen events, ends up with these abnormalities. There's no guarantee of a perfect child, and God doesn't create an imperfection.
Well said, Kara. Well said on both sides of your argument there. On the first side, that there is no guarantee of a perfect child, and in one sense, every child is perfect if you really trust in God, perfect in the most important ways, and none of us is perfect in every way. In fact, none of us is perfect in any way. That's just a reminder of how frail and fragile human beings really are. And we can look and say, well, look, there's a healthy baby, but who knows what's in that baby's future? God knows. We don't. You can say, well, there's a baby that has all kinds of problems, and what kind of quality of life can it ever have? Well, how would you know? And even if so, what is our human obligation to this baby? To say it should never have been born? or to welcome it as a member of the human family and do our very best to allow and to nurture that baby to thrive. Thanks for your call, Kara. Let's go to Carrie, listening on WHCB in Kingsport, Tennessee. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hello. Personal experience of mine, Dr. Moeller. My wife is 3 months pregnant with our sixth child, and the first ultrasound to determine the sex of the baby showed two cysts on the baby's brain, which could lead to Down syndrome. We had the second ultrasound. The cyst no longer existed. But in the meantime, we were completely committed to that child because that's our obligation. That's our godly obligation.
Carrie, you are calling with the voice of experience. Let me ask you if you can just speak to us, and I don't want to invade the privacy of your relationship with your wife, but if you'll allow us here, let me just ask you, what kind of thoughts went through your minds as you were trying to make this decision? How did you come to a firm decision that you were going to welcome this child, whatever? Can you tell us this?
It was never a consideration, Dr. Moeller. Our faith in God gives us the confidence that He works well in all instances. My wife went immediately when she found out the cyst and searched the Internet, which was terrible because she learned about Down syndrome, everything. And she was very unfortunate. It was very emotional for her. But, you know, the voice of God's reason in her life said, you know, God is in charge. God, if the baby is healthy as an ox or as delicate and fragile as a flower petal, He's ours. We are the caretakers for God of that child.
That's a very sweet statement, Carrie. And now tell me, when is your wife expecting? When is the due date?
In August.
Well, all right. And you have five already. Tell us about it. Boys or girls?
We have three girls and expecting a third boy. And we've already had one miscarriage, which gives us, you know, this is our seventh pregnancy. And we are just so blessed.
Well, you're going to have three and three, and that sounds like it ought to be a team of something there, Carrie. God bless you. That's just that is a full quiver, and God's blessings to you. Thank you so much for your call. You know, folks, Carrie said something that really brings to my mind the fallibility of the medical profession. All you have to do is know that the medical technology that is available to us now is a modern marvel. Indeed, in an almost non-exaggerated way, we could say it's a modern miracle. There are many of us alive, I'm one of them, alive today because of these medical technologies. Nothing too sophisticated in my case, really, except antibiotics. I got a necrotizing fasciitis, the flesh-eating bacterium, back several years ago. And in any previous age, I would be dead. I would not be here to talk. But wonderful doctors and medical care and the right antibiotic knocked that back. And that can kill many people, as it does. And then appendicitis. You know, if you got appendicitis a couple hundred years ago, you didn't make it. But now I'm very thankful for this kind of medical technology. And there are people today who are living vigorous and healthy lives whose lives are completely turned around by medical technology. But, you know, there is still no omniscience when you put on that white gown. There's still no omniscience from medical tests. There are all kinds of false positives and false negatives. You know, we are to trust, aren't we? And yet there is such a temptation to trust medicine rather than to trust God. And I'm not saying by any means that medicine does not have a role to play. I'm not saying that doctors do not have a voice that ought to be heard. I'm not saying that there's not information there that we need to know and that there are not technologies there that should be made available. But technologies to save, not technologies to kill. Technologies to heal, not technologies to redefine what it means to be human by stopping life, terminating life before it's born. We'll be right back. This has been a really good discussion of the tentative pregnancy and how we as Christians should think about it. And let's just go back to the bottom line. We as Christians are obligated to welcome all life as God's gift. We are not in the consumer business when it comes to offspring. We are not in a position to define what it should mean to be human. That is our Creator's definition. That's His prerogative. It is not ours to decide what kind of minimum IQ we will accept, what kind of syndrome we will reject. It's not ours to say. And that's not to minimize the fact that there can be excruciating realities that the families can experience. There can be awful diseases. There are. There are awful syndromes and situations. Of course there are. But is the answer to our human reality, to our human nature, to our human responsibility to eliminate these lies before they are born? Of course not. Shame on us for ever thinking so. When I wrote my article on this and published it yesterday at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com, I got a few letters of affirmation, and I got also letters of condemnation. One of the most interesting letters condemning my argument is written by a woman who said, look, and again, she wrote with a first-person experience. She said, we have a child that suffers from a disease like this. She said, everyone has to do what is right in his own sight. Well, that is right out of the Bible as a recipe for disaster. When everyone does what is right in his or her own sight, you have pure moral anarchy. And there's no other area of life in which we can allow that to happen. And it will not long happen here, not before we have a complete breakdown of human dignity and an assault upon the very sanctity of human life that will affect every single human life, not just the lives of those who are considered to be defective or unacceptable, but the lives of every one of us. Carrie made an interesting point, by the way, about his wife going to the internet to look for information and being scared to death. Let me just warn you again, there is all kinds of good information out there, but you can really get scared to death if you go to some of these internet sites. Just back about Christmas time, my wife had made so many wonderful cookies, and she had set aside for her parents some wonderful chocolate surprise cookies. And she was surprised to find out that our wonderful beagle, Baxter, had eaten them. Well, Baxter is a beagle who isn't supposed to be eating chocolate. So the women of the family started Googling to find out how much danger Baxter was in. And it was about time to write his obit. Awful stuff about what happens when a beagle eats chocolate. There is no hope. Abandon all hope. The dog is doomed. Well, fortunately, Baxter can't read anything on the internet, and he's doing quite fine, thank you. Don't believe everything you read. Get the best medical advice, but trust the highest authority. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.